Good. What I want to study this evening is to look at the English Civil War. And as you can imagine, it's a massive topic. And when focusing in upon a certain period, we need to bear in mind that lots has happened before leading up to that time. And, you know, we're kind of choosing the Civil War, but we do need to understand a little bit that leads up to that. Otherwise, historically, we're not quite sure where we are. And the developments that happened leading up to the Civil War can help us understand the implications and the impact of those actions and decisions that were made. So in a sense, we have to look back behind the events we're going to focus upon, which is the Civil War. We can't go back too deeply. English history is just so full that if we go back in too much detail, we'd spend a whole lecture series on Henry VIII, for example. And we're not going to move very fast. I don't intend this to be a drawn-out series. It's going to take a couple of sessions, but we want to begin tonight at least to just looking at some history leading up to that period. And we'll see, as we look at this Civil War, it's not an arbitrary decision to choose the English Civil War at this stage. I think it's very pertinent and relevant to our circumstances, to where we're at in our nation, and we kind of notice that things don't change much. Man's heart continues to be pulled in a particular direction. And so it's vital that we notice the progression in the thinking of those involved in the conflict and understand why certain things were done in the way they were done. And we can see the minds changing as circumstances made them think through issues in a different way to what they had previously received and just presumed to be true. And we'll see the very real life lessons that we can learn from that progression in their thinking. So we're going to just start at Henry VIII. He came to the throne in 1509 at the age of 17. This was the same year that John Calvin was born. The Pope was the head of the church in England at the time. And Luther wrote the 95 Theses in 1517. So you've got that kind of time frame in Henry's life. Henry VIII's first wife, Catherine, had given birth to a daughter in 1516, whom they called Mary. And Henry then sought to annul this marriage to Catherine and marry another lady named Anne Boleyn. The Pope at that stage refused to annul his marriage, and so in 1533, Thomas Cranmer, who was Archbishop of Canterbury, he declared the marriage of Henry and Catherine to be null and void. And Henry's marriage to Anne to be valid. Anne gave birth to a daughter whom they called Elizabeth, who was also declared to be the next in line to succeed Henry VIII. So they cancelled out Mary's lineage from Catherine and declared that Anne's new baby, Elizabeth, would be the next in line. Henry VIII had begun his reign as king as a devout Roman Catholic, but had along the way changed, and we're not quite sure when exactly he changed and why exactly. We know it had to do with the annulment, but there was also evidence that he was already feeling the threat of the Pope being over him, and he was trying to break loose from that kind of authority over him. And as you can see in his understanding of the rights of kings, you can see where that conflict would have come into his mind. And we'll see, as Henry is working through these struggles, personal problems, and also, I suppose it was personal as well, but hanging onto the throne, but seeing that he wanted to be freed from the control of the Pope, we'll see that the Reformation in England takes on a different kind of flavor. Because in the rest of Europe now, what's going on is the Reformation. The 95 Theses have been published. You've got stuff happening. You've got the reformers coming onto the scene, and you've got the Reformation coming through the ecclesiastical means. It's the churches that are clashing. There was political aspects to it, definitely, but it was Reformation of the church primarily. In England, it was more political Reformation. It was more Henry wanting to secure his political power and wanting to back that up with the church, but it was political in nature as opposed to, let's purify the church. He wanted this church to support his political position. And so it was somewhat different in England. The Reformation was real, and you had guys in England who, you know, obviously wanted to go further, but really what was taking place was more a political Reformation at the time. And so with this break with Rome, Henry rejected the idea of the Pope and that the church could be over the king, and thus he declared an act of supremacy where the king is supreme over all. So he made this law, wrote it into law, and he made himself the head at that point. He made himself the head of the church as well. So he kind of just took the Pope's position in a sense and made himself head of the church and head of the nation and combined those two things together. He also abolished the right of appeal to Rome, which was something that was on the law books in in the Holy Roman Empire. And then the Pope responded by excommunicating Henry. Henry, it appears, had grown tired of Anne at this stage. And so there were treason charges brought up against her and had her arrested and executed along with her brother and some others. 10 days after this execution, Anne's daughter, she had borne her Elizabeth, Anne's daughter was removed from the king's line as well. He said, Elizabeth is no longer in line to receive the kingdom. And the king then married Jane Seymour. Jane Seymour provided Henry with the much desired son and the heir that he really wanted, and he named him Edward. This was a very difficult birth, and not long after the birth, Jane Seymour died. And this was in 1536. So this 1536 is when Calvin releases the first edition of his Institutes. 1536 is when William Tyndale was executed, praying at that time, O Lord, open the King of England's eyes. 1539 was when the major Bible was published in English with the blessing of the king, which was mostly Tyndale's work. Now, with the break of the church with Rome, Henry had to endorse the 10 articles in August 1536. However, these were involved in the Reformation of the church, but they weren't moving very far from that. And Henry got to a point where he was kind of scared of the speed that the people involved in trying to reform the church were moving. And so the articles, the 10 articles of 1536, he counted them in 1539 with the 6 articles, and in that he kind of slowed down Reformation, kept some of the traditions, the Roman Catholic traditions, the view of the Mass was kept, the sacraments were kept, the priesthood and some of those aspects that were from the Church of Rome were kept in the new Church of England. And Henry had 6 wives, so he married again after the death of Jane Seymour, and married another Anne, and then another Catherine, and then another Catherine. And so if you want to remember his wives, there's a saying, it was divorced, beheaded, died, divorced, beheaded, survived. Upon the death of Henry VIII in January 1547, his son Edward became Edward VI of England. And he was a devout Protestant. He was young when he came to the throne, 9 years old, and the people who were his guidance and counselors were also very strong Protestants, and they really made huge strides. And he was a very bright boy as well. If you read about him, you'll see it's amazing what he grasped and understood at a very young age. And so great strides were made in advancing the Protestant Reformation in the church as well. You know, they're changing stuff within the church. Unfortunately, young Edward fell sick and very ill with a lung infection, maybe tuberculosis. And when they realized that he was dying, he, together with his council, hurriedly drew up a succession plan to keep the throne in Protestant hands. So in 1553, he was gravely ill and dying, and they drew up the succession plan where a cousin or a first removed cousin, I don't even know what that means, but some relative who was a strong Protestant, Lady Jane Grey, was to succeed Edward. And Edward then died in 1553 at the age of 15. And Lady Jane Grey is a great example of true faith, courage, and godliness in this woman. However, Henry's first daughter, Mary, who had been cut off from the throne, her mother was Catherine, the first marriage. She was a devout Roman Catholic raised by her mother, who was Spanish and Roman Catholic. And she now laid claim to the throne in the line of Henry, saying, I should be the next queen. And she then raised a force and moved on to claim the throne. She is known as Bloody Mary. Mary the First of England is another way you can know her of. She reigned until 1558. Now, the reason she got that name was because when she came to the English throne, now you had these huge strides of Protestant advancement, and suddenly this devout Roman Catholic is on the throne, and she immediately started turning the tables back and removing everything and rejoining up with Rome and then persecuting severely the Protestants. She had burnt at the stake over 280 Protestants in the 5 years that she was Queen of England, and so hence her name, Bloody Mary. And so she took the nation back into the fold of Rome. And amongst those Protestants that were burned at the stake were names that you know, Hugh Latimer, who was the chaplain to Edward VI. He was the king's chaplain, the former king. He was executed. Nicholas Ridley. That's the thing. Latimer and Ridley were burned at the stake together. And I've spoken about them before. One of them couldn't burn, so his legs were burning to a crisp, but the top half of his body couldn't catch a light, and so there were no vital organs dying, so he suffered greatly, but with great courage. Also, who was executed this time was a man by the name of John Bradford. He was a preacher. I have two volumes of his collected writings on my shelves. And also Thomas Cranmer, who was Archbishop of Canterbury. So you had some big names in the groups that were put to death by Bloody Mary throughout those 5 years. Mary died in 1558 from some ailment, and since she had no child and had reversed Henry's annulling of his heirs, this meant that Mary's younger sister Elizabeth took the throne. Now, Elizabeth was a Protestant, and so you had the swing back to the Protestant side. She was the daughter of Anne Boleyn, the second wife of Henry VIII, and Elizabeth had one of the longest reigning, longest reigning reigns. Eh? She reigned for 44 years and was known as, which was known as the Elizabethan Age. This was William Shakespeare's days, and so that was the cultural aspect that was being developed. One of the first things that Elizabeth did was to establish the Protestant Church in England and declare herself the supreme governor of the church. She changed from her father's claim to be the supreme head of the church, which made it a little bit more palatable with some of the Christians. So I'm just the supreme governor. The Church of England, or Anglican Church, was established by the Act of Uniformity passed in 1559, whereby worship and prayer were bound to the Book of Common Prayer. Elizabeth had no toleration, however, for those reformers who sought to take the reformation of the church even further. These were the Puritans who took that name because they wanted to purify the church of all the taints of Rome and all the human traditions like signing of the cross at baptism. You know, they would do the sign and they would wear surplices, which was that gown that covered your clothes when you were preaching. So they wanted to remove all that and get away from all these traditions that they felt were distracting. Now, when Henry VIII was throwing off the chains of Rome in England, James V was king in Scotland. And he was a devout Roman Catholic. He remained faithful to the Roman Church. So you had Henry VIII rebelling against Rome, James V in Scotland staying with the Pope. James V died in 1542 when his only legitimate child, he had lots of illegitimate children, but his only legitimate child was 6 days old, and her name was Mary. Another Mary comes into the picture, not Bloody Mary. This is Mary of Scotland, Queen of Scots. Now, when Elizabeth succeeded Bloody Mary, Mary I of England, the Roman Catholics, Mary was the Roman Catholic in England. Many Roman Catholics claimed that Elizabeth's claim to the throne was illegitimate, and this Mary in Scotland, another Mary, Mary I of Scotland, was the rightful heir to the English throne. And so they wanted her to come and take the throne in England. And we need to leave a whole lot out what is going on in Scotland. There was great upheaval, and eventually Mary, Queen of Scots, was forced to flee, and she came into England, and in England she started to plot against Elizabeth, and she was held in captivity, and that went on for a while. But when she was driven away from Scotland, Mary I, her son, who was James VI, became King of Scotland. He was also a youth at the time, and he only gained full control of Scotland in 1583. But James VI's rule in Scotland was influenced by the growing Protestant Reformation. So there was great struggles in the church there, and he shifted towards the Reformation with guys like Knox and his guys who followed John Knox. And so there was change in his thinking, or so it appeared. And so that kind of looked good on the horizon for the English people, they thought. And so Mary was eventually, Mary I, Queen of Scots, was eventually executed in England for trying to overthrow Elizabeth. And we are told that later on, when Queen Elizabeth died in 1603, James VI of Scotland, who'd been influenced by the reformers, was then invited to become King of England and be James I of England. So he would be King of Scotland and England. But they changed his title to James I when he became King of England. And as Geoffrey Robertson says, James I had been invited from Scotland to take the English throne on Elizabeth's death. And then when he did that, the optimism among the Puritans in England that a man from the austere Calvinistic Kirk would look sympathetically on their similar form of worship was soon dashed. James was obsessed with his God-given right to rule as an absolute prince through a hierarchy supported by archbishops and bishops alongside his counselors and favorite courtiers. From the outset of his reign, he urged the Anglican authorities to discipline ministers who refused to follow approved rituals or who spoke on politics from the pulpit. He knew exactly where the Puritans' hostility to hierarchy in their church would lead. He said, no bishop, no king. So he kept the hierarchy structure in the church and said, we're not changing that. You can't worship how you want. James's view that the king, as God's anointed, possessed unquestionable authority and he had to give account to God alone. So the king had unquestionable authority. The only one he was answerable to was God. And this led him to order the new translation, a new version of the Bible, because the most popular Bible, especially among the Puritans, was the Geneva Bible, which contained the reformer's notes, and in there was something that stuck in his throat in the notes of the Geneva Bible. And that was when the Hebrew midwives resisted Pharaoh, and when he told them to kill the young Hebrew boys as they were helping them to be born, and they refused to do that, and this made him angry by the note, because the note in the Geneva Bible said, their disobedience herein was lawful. And to James, this was just anathema. And so he said about that was one of the motivating things. He had to get this Puritan Bible, the Geneva Bible, out of the hands of the people. That was the most common version. And so they set about translating the King James Version, which was published in 1611. A glorious accomplishment in its right, the Bible itself and the language, but from the worst motivation. And yeah, I wonder if how much impact, you know, losing that understanding of that passage has had to where we are today. Now, James indoctrinated his son Charles with this doctrine as he raised him, and he defended this doctrine with great devotion. He wrote a book on the subject of the divine rights of kings, and James said that the king's advisors, made up of bishops and other counselors, this is it, must never question the royal prerogative, for that is to take away the mystical reverence that belongs to those that sit in the throne of God. And as Robertson says, in this Stuart was the family name of this line of kings. He says, in this Stuart utopia, Parliament was irritating and irrelevant, and alternative religions were positively dangerous. By other religions here, he meant other forms of worship within the Protestant body, like the Puritans. He wasn't talking about some other religion like Buddhism or Islam. King James wrote another book to refute the idea coming out of Geneva that, and this is what was coming through the teaching of the Geneva Bible and also just through the teaching from Geneva itself, that monarchy entailed a contract with the people who might resist and remove a king if he breached it. Okay, so that's the teaching. He's saying no. And he wrote a book to refute that idea. On the contrary, James claimed, the monarch is the absolute master of the lives and possessions of his subjects. His acts are not open to injury or dispute, and no misdeeds can ever justify resistance. No misdeeds can ever justify resistance. And that's what James wrote in his book. It's quoted in Robertson's book, The Tyrannicide Brief. A man by the name of Edward Coke, who was the Chief Justice in England, once at a Privy Council meeting in 1608, challenged the king's understanding on the subject. And when the king said at this meeting that since he was divinely ordained and thus the supreme judge on earth, he could override the decisions of any of the other judges, all of whom he had appointed and could dismiss at will. Judges might be lions under the throne, but they were under it and tethered. When the king said that, the chief justice said, well, maybe that's true, the judges are tethered and under your throne. But nevertheless, the king was bound to obey the common law, he said. He said, the law is the golden metal wand and measure to try the causes of your majesty's subjects, and it is by that law that your majesty is protected in safety and peace. Okay, kind of a very mild statement. It is that law that protects you. It's that law that keeps you in check and provides peace. Robertson says, at this, King James flew into a rage, screaming that it was treason to say that he was under the law. The king lurched forward to punch Coke, but the chief justice prostrated himself and begged for mercy. And so he got by that confrontation with the king. Robertson says, it had been a courageous moment, and Coke's short-lived defiance at the time had little support. James I's subjects believed that the king's authority was bestowed by God, a belief endorsed by all other judges. Monarchical government was ordained by God, and resistance to the king's power was both mortal sin and treason. And so that was the mindset of the day, and this man had a flicker of questioning it. Others didn't even dare to question it in their minds, let alone verbalize it. And we see how the king responded. Robertson continues, James's assertion that the king could do no wrong would never be tested during his reign. Judges were not minded to assert any power over him. They weren't reminded, they weren't told to, because they lacked tenure of their office and could always be sacked if they displeased him. The Chief Justice Coke himself was dismissed from his position for that very reason in 1616. He had infuriated James once again, this time by refusing to concede that the king was entitled to summon the judges to a private consultation about a case to do with the king. Sorry, about a case to which the king was the party. So the king was saying, I'm going to call all the judges in the land to a private meeting about a matter which involves me. So I'm trying to take John's land over there, and we've got some conflict of interest, so I'm going to call a private meeting with all the judges. And Coke said, hey, this is wrong. And so he was dismissed from his position. Coke wasn't standing for justice. He could see these things. Him personally wasn't a great man. He wasn't an honorable, but he could see things that this doesn't make sense. Even though maybe he couldn't wrap his arms around them fully, he understood these issues and at least started airing them that could begin challenging the thinking of others. As Robertson pointed out, challenging the absolute claim of royal power would require a different breed of men, with a faith firm enough to transcend trivial temptations of earthly wealth or privilege. Not, don't want to lose my job, don't want to lose my life, don't want to lose my inheritance, whatever it is. So it was going to require something more than that. When James died, he was succeeded by his son Charles I, who ascended to the throne in March 1625. Charles had been fully indoctrinated in his father's teaching about the divine rights of kings, and it would be Charles who would take on Parliament at the time when a different breed of men had been raised up by God. And so that's where we lead up to, into seeing now how that's going to unfold as James starts to flex his muscles and flex his father's philosophy of the divine rights of king in the context where people were now starting to think in the Puritan mindset, in the Geneva mindset, and being understanding in these things. And you have men being raised up like Oliver Cromwell and others. And one man in particular that we'll get to, that whose name you probably have never heard of, who is an incredible example of courage and faith as we head towards the English Civil War, which was the king and Parliament going to battle over ideas. And those are the ideas of whose jurisdiction is where and how do we protect liberty. And unfortunately, we need to pick that up next time. And so that will be following on with Charles I.